That's the Juju Orchestra with its wonderful song or tune, This Is Not a Tango. That's from their 2007 album, Bossa Nova Is Not a Crime. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, January the 26th, 2015. And the Northeast braces itself for a huge winter storm that forecasters say will bring 2 to 3 feet of snow and near hurricane force winds. Already thousands of flights in and out of the region have been canceled. It's supposed to be pretty devastating later on, but we shall see. I want to talk today about race and power, the race and power conundrum, and whether there is any way out. Today, of course, marks the seventh day, the full week, since all the reverence, due reverence, given to the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. on the occasion of Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And as it is normally the case, America paused for a hot second and it's back to its natural mode. And the strains of King's historic exhortations on freedom, justice, and equality have been muffled by the roar of business as usual. America did pay its symbolic respects to King and his so-called dream. They reminded us all that things are much better now. America is in a much better place. Americans have progressed. Besides, there is a movie, and we should all move on. But we know, of course, that that's not true. We know that there still remains this deep fissure in our society, based on race. This is the basis on which the country was founded. This is, in fact, seminal to its history. And the permanent recurring theme. So, when we look at civil rights struggles against natural rights rule and control, we have to ask the question, is there any way out? And if there is, or maybe there's more than one, some might surmise, then what are these ways? The recent report that has shaken up France, for example, was that the French Prime Minister, Manuel Valls, declared that France is and has been in a state, and he used this word, of apartheid. That's the word he used. And he said it's time for France to come to terms with it, to deal with it, to call it what it is. Of course, this is in the aftermath, as you know, of the attacks on Charlie Hebdo, the so-called satirical magazine, in which 12 people were killed there, and later others were killed, bringing to a total of 17 people killed allegedly by terrorists. But in the aftermath of that very violent statement made by these terrorists, he acknowledged and he upset France quite a bit by saying, and his words are, France needs to look inward at a territorial, social, and ethnic apartheid as the reality of France. It is the reality of the United States of America as well. And immediately after he said this, there were howls of protests among the establishment that was just the wrong word to use. It was an awful and inaccurate assessment of the situation. But it is accurate, an assessment, I believe, in France and in the United States. We have been living in what South Africans came to call apartheid, a rigidly organized society along the notions of white supremacy and black subjugation. And not just black, but anybody not white being subjected to life as a subordinate in the society. When Dr. King's day was celebrated, there was a great deal of effort made to persuade us that there had been so much progress. But the reality doesn't kind of square up with that. We do see a racially bifurcated society, and not just in terms of race. We see it in terms of all other aspects of life, economically, educationally, politically, and otherwise. We talked about housing just last week, how the government organized and orchestrated policies to ensure unequal housing, which is, of course, illegal. So we always come back to this point. A deliberate effort to maintain the system of white supremacy, the push against it, a kind of détente, a kind of negotiation where there's a little give, perhaps, but even within that give, you have systems of control that could nullify whatever the agreements have been, and you're back to square one again. And sometimes you're worse off than before you started. We heard Martin Luther King say in one of the speeches that was played, and at the time, this was 1967, he talked about the enormous gap of wealth and income. He talked about the fact that black unemployment was at least, if not more than twice that of whites. He talked about inequality in education. He talked about inequality in housing. He talked about the economic struggle being at front and center of this effort to arrive at some degree of justice and equality in this country. He said pointedly that it was much easier to integrate a bus. But the fight really isn't about integrating buses or lunch counters. The fight is for full equality in this country. Well, as we know, the American marketing syndrome gives us the wherewithal to celebrate Dr. King and his ideas, his dream, his non-threatening dream for a good hot second, and then that's over, and then, you know, just move on. But I say today, let's kind of pause here and ask the question, in this race conundrum, this race and power play, are we approaching any point, any milestone here in which we believe that there's reason to hope that there could be something meaningful coming out of it? Or are we just on a treadmill repeating the same old, same old, same old, expecting entirely different results, which is another way of saying we are gradually descending into a kind of denial and madness. In the same way that Prime Minister Manuel Valls of France decided that the time had come to name the beast that afflicts France, that has just jammed it up and created an untenable situation internally. Should we not also name the beast here and say, without any uncertainty whatsoever, that we know the beast that we are dealing with? I want to talk about this race and power conundrum because, and perhaps this is just the way things work out, the heavy lifting historically has been assigned, it seems, to the people doing the suffering. They're the ones who have to take on the burden of transforming an unjust society, compelling it to be humane, compelling it to behave itself, to adhere to some standard of decency. This too is a conundrum, that the people who are suffering the most are also burdened, it seems, with the responsibility for transforming the society. And as we have seen, when in fact they did do that, they did not yield the benefit of their effort. Their hard work, their heavy lifting, was transmuted and devolved again back into that segment of society that was able to lift itself into orbit on the strength of those people's struggles. So the conundrum has to do with this notion of civil rights, rights derived from amendments to the Constitution. Amendments that say, all right, okay, you got us, okay, we'll give you this and that and the next, now go away. Those rights that are negotiated rights, always up against the natural rights of those who belong to the supreme class by virtue of their skin color, and very little else is required in this country. The year 2035 is around the corner. And in that year, according to the U.S. Bureau of the Census, a dramatic demographic shift will have occurred in the United States. And that shift says that the United States will have become a majority non-white nation. Well, that is going to cause a lot of problems. It already has begun. Because you see, if indeed the operative power equation in the United States has to do with color or race, as they invented it, this term, race, if the dominant race is going to be outnumbered, and we are assured based on the figures of the U.S. Bureau of the Census, and I think we can accept that they are an authority on demographics, but if they are communicating right now that whiteness as the central focus of power in the country will have been altered, or the notion of whiteness altered by virtue of this demographic shift just around the corner, 2035, then what is going to happen to the whole concept of maintaining power? What are the changes that are going to happen? We're seeing some of them already. I already described to you several times how you should look at this notion of democracy and equality and even justice. It is to be measured not by voting, but by access to the strategic resources of our society. Justice is a resource. Education, healthcare, safety, housing, employment. These are strategic resources. And if power is to be exercised by the dominant group, and if the dominant group had, since the country officially, quote-unquote, was established, was determined to be eternally in the hands of people designated as whites, and if whites are going to be outnumbered by the year 2035, then how then is power to be maintained by the supreme group? And if power is to be maintained by the supreme group on the basis of race, and this devaluation is occurring by virtue of numbers dwindling in the group called whites, how then will the allocation of resources continue? See, what I'm saying in effect is, what we are looking at is a dramatic shift not only in the population, the ethnicity of the population, and the ethnicity of the group assigning itself as supreme in this country. We're looking also at fewer people having to manage the resources. So they will now have to take on an additional burden because the numbers are going to be depleted, but the resources are still going to be available. What does that mean? Well, either they get more zealous about their greed and about the notion that they have to do something more to hold on to these resources because they're not about to share them. To share them would be to bring in this concept that they've been resisting all along, which is equality and democracy and freedom and fairness. So they're not about to be generous enough to achieve democracy and freedom and equality and fairness. So they will become far more stringent in their control of resources. Or they can relax the rules a little bit and decide that they will bring some more members into the club so that people who previously were not entirely welcomed into the club of whiteness and supremacy may now have a shot in order to amplify the numbers. Or maybe both will happen. There will be a more stringent regulation of these strategic resources, which will maintain inequality, no democracy, no fairness. It will maintain that standard order. And they get to flush out the numbers a bit more. I remind you that not too long ago, there were ethnic groups. They called them ethnic groups, which is an interesting word, considering that everybody is of an ethnic group. But again, if you occupy a position of supremacy, you get to name things. And one of the things they decided was that there were some people who, yeah, with a shove, with a little push, they could kind of sort of be white. But for purposes of supremacy, we will keep them in their place. The Irish were among that group. Italians were among that group. Ethnic groups from the Mediterranean were among that group. And the record shows the country was quite confused about this notion of whiteness. Because at one point, Arabs were white. At one point, Asians were white. At one point, anybody with a so-called Hispanic surname was white. And then Dominicans showed up and they said, oh, let's revise. So whiteness is a very strange concept, depending on the political instructions of supremacy and the convenience of supremacy. But what I'm saying here today, and I want us to kind of flesh this out a little bit more, is that look at what we're facing. Look at the experience we already have had with this power and race conundrum. Where is it going? Have we sufficiently found some kind of an exit out of it? Is it likely to continue? Whose job is it to rectify the situation? Are we going to be brave enough as a country to find people in leadership position, such as in France, when the Prime Minister says, what we have here, folks, is apartheid. Economic apartheid, ethnic apartheid, social apartheid, but we have apartheid here in France. Never mind your ideas of your so-called cultural and national sophistication. We are a country existing in really primitive conditions. And much of what we will suffer as a nation has to do with our unwillingness to recognize it, to name it, and to begin the process of dealing with the reality of it. So I bring this thought to you today, and I ask for your input. What do you see? What is the future here? You know, we don't want to go through many more years of, you know, we have the obligatory pause on Martin Luther King Day, and the nation gets a half a jolt of conscience, and then the next day life goes on. And in connection with Martin Luther King Day, we have other endeavors related. We have the obligatory marches, all of it symbolic, because nobody's doing the work. Or very few are doing the work of transforming the society on all sides. We have a lot of symbolism, lots of symbolism, not much in the way of work. We'll take a break and come to your thoughts. 888-874-4888. Let's get down to some serious discussion here today, right after this. You're listening to PRN.FM, and you're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. We're talking about America's race and power conundrum. Is there a way out? And if so, what do you think it might be? At 888-874-4888. We're talking about this not because anybody has absolute answers. More so, it's that we haven't been raising the questions. we haven't been raising the right questions here. We've been avoiding it. We've been talking about it in indirect ways. But it's time to have this conversation. I've been talking about the need to have the conversation, because all sides are important in this conversation. It's not going to be an easy kind of, one of those, theoretical conversations. We want something substantive. What are your thoughts about this? How do we approach this question? Are we ever to hope, or can we ever entertain the idea that America would actually at some point come to grips with the reality of the situation? Or are we going to be on a treadmill forever, going on this hypothetical feel-good exercise without saying this is the problem? I mean, we even had the president talking about, look how far we've come. And you wonder, well, geez, what is your point? Where have you been? What is your historical reference? What is your reference at all on any matter relating to this power equation? 888-874-4888. Gregory from Maryland, what are you thinking?
Hello, Eutrice. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm pretty good. One thing that we can do, this country has been dumbing down its whole population, white and black, and we need to concentrate on education, because when I was in school, we were about, 19 in the world as far as education, and now we're at 43rd.
Okay, I'm listening.
Well, that's our problem. We have destroyed the young people's education. When we came along, blacks and whites didn't go to school together, so they were sort of unknowing about each other. Now they do. And it's time to move on and build a better nation, you know?
But let me ask you, Gregory, when you say, for example, that education is required, and I agree with that, but we have had that as well. We have had many attempts at educating people as to how to live with each other. Do we need to know the defined details of each other's history? I don't know. It would help. But I would imagine that one should be at a stage at this point, the country should be at a stage at this point where we can engage. We've had enough time for education to take place. Are you suggesting we haven't actually done a good job of education?
Well, we did fall down with the youth. They're sort of out of control. They changed the way they teach reading and math, and ever since they changed it, they can't do it.
But how does that have to do? What does that have to do, I should say, with this power equation that we're talking about here, in terms of a social system that encompasses everybody, in which we understand allegedly that we live in a democratic society, and these concepts of freedom and democracy and equality are not just theoretical but attainable and real?
That's biting off a lot, but basically, this is a problem where the whole country is slipping to a third world status. and you know other corporations. What's the computer guy's name? He brings over computer wizards from India, where they have a special college there, and that takes away American jobs, you know. And as far as us, you know, moving forward as a nation, we need to work on power, because the power is in corporate hands, and it's not being used very wisely, and it's losing ground internationally as far as our status as, you know, what used to be a leading country of the world.
Well, thank you for your contribution today. Thank you so much for your call, Gregory, from Maryland. Maat from New York, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon, all.
Thank you.
I agree with many of your theses around this, and I want to expand on Gregory's point. I think we need to bring up and make especially black people aware of Neely Fuller's work. And you can probably pull up, because that one book he did has a long title, which I can't say right now. But Neely Fuller was a fairly average, ordinary guy. Are you familiar with him?
Yes.
Yes. And he went in the Army and looked around, and he was the one who came up with, if you don't understand European white supremacy, everything else you know will only confuse you. And there are many of us who have inserted patriarchal neocolonial in there, which I'm sure he'd agreed with. And then, of course, Dr. Frances Cress Wells, in her book, The ISIS Papers, and other works, many have expanded on it. So I think one solution, because it's not an easy nut to crack, as it were, is to deal with those scholars who have pointed this European supremacy out in a very cogent manner. But I think we also need to drill down further, because I heard you state that at one point Asians and Arabs were considered white. That can be debated, because I think about those cases where I can't think of the Japanese man's name, but he was trying to get citizenship. And at some point, because he was a Christian and this and that, and he wanted to get his citizenship, he petitioned to be considered white. I don't know if you're familiar with that case, but it's a famous case.
There's a group called the Critical Race Theorists. They tend to be lawyers, most of them. And one of the best books I could think of, is just one of them, but there are many, is a book by Ian Haney, H-A-N-E-Y, Lopez, called White by Law. And he traces U.S. Supreme Court decisions on determining whiteness. So it basically says that this is a political construct, and it is reinforced by the judicial system. And at one point, the other arms and branches of government, but it has to do with how crazy it is and how made up it all is.
Let me get
this notion of whiteness.
You said Haney William. Let me make sure I have the name for the book you trace.
Ian I A N Haney H A N E Y Lopez L O P E C.
I got that. Are you
and
familiar?
We also have Theodore Allen's The Invention of the White Race. It's newly reissued. It's an excellent book. But we're not talking about books. We're talking about this notion of the race and power conundrum in our society. Whose job is it to fix it?
Well, I think as black folks, this is something that we have to address, because most so-called white people are unaware that they actually have a special status. And the reason how we can confirm that whiteness being a status code is when you go back to the Black's Law Dictionary and secure a copy, I think, of the fourth edition or before, the definition of whiteness is very curious and defines the Ethiopians as whites. I think they even have something in there, the fourth or prior edition. I think the fifth edition changes it. I'm not totally sure. As free white and 21. And lastly, let me ask you, have you also heard, I understand there's a book out there called The History of Whiteness. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Yes, I don't know the book, but I just know
history,
the title.
A Brief History of White People, I think it's called.
Well, I might be thinking about a different book.
But, okay, well, you got your points across today. Thank you. I wanted to move beyond books. There are lots and lots of books out there, but they still don't seem to be informing our decisions to move wisely. And this is the topic. From Sarah, what do you think?
Oh, greetings to you, Eutrice, and the PRN audience.
Thank you.
Yes, Eutrice. To tag on a little bit on what my aunt mentioned earlier about, you know, this notion that white people are unaware of their status in society and they're ignorant and they're, you know, they need to be taught. You know, this is a disservice that we're not only doing to white people, but we're doing to ourselves. When we are not talking about individual white people, when we are making this statement, at least this is not what I make when I make this statement. I'm not looking at each individual white person. I'm making a tag. This is a collective status that is an umbrella where everyone falls under this umbrella who classifies or calls themselves as being a white person. And it's something that they get. It's a benefit that you derive from directly if you participate in the system or indirectly as a result of what the system has to give. And when black people would get out from that misunderstanding that this is something individual, that we're dealing with each white person on an individual basis, then perhaps we can move further because it has nothing to do with individuality. White people don't work as individual. They work as a collective in this system when the system was structured. Now, according to what you were saying about this judicial process that we have here, as well as the economic process, and she mentioned Mr. Fuller as well as Dr. Frances Cress Welsing and her theory that she has put out here about the systems and the different structures that it falls under as far as race goes, and it's not only based on one particular area; it's the nine different areas of people activity that it governs. And we all participate either directly or indirectly into this system, whether we willingly or not. You know, we all fall into it. But I get tired, Eutrice, of people always saying that, you know, it's always based upon black people. We have to be the one, as you say, to lift that cotton tote, that bale, do all that hard work. And then somebody else comes in and reap the benefit. And we've been doing it consistently in all of our different movements. We've always been the one to do all of the labor. And then there's always a hierarchy at the top that is not black, that do the directing, that controls it, and then they take it off into direction because ultimately it was always about something different that they want to do for themselves. So they tag on to our movement and they come along with it, get it to a certain point, and then they took off and do whatever it is that they have to do. And if we, as you know, as you, you're a scholar of Dr. Ben as well as Dr. Clark, and it's something that you're going to have to do. This is something that we black people are going to have to take on and do it for ourselves, by ourselves, because no one can bring us or give us liberation. We are not going to get it through the courts. We are not going to get it marching or picketing in the streets. We are not going to get it. It's not going to come that way. Nobody's going to sit down one day and says, okay, we're going to legislatively give it to black people because we've done it. They have done it all the way from all these different the emancipation, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, but it has not done us anything. All these different civil rights bills, it has not done anything for us because putting action on a piece of paper with no ability to enforce it is not doing you any justice.
But I'm asking the question, Sarah. You seem to have a pretty good handle on that side of the issue. I'm asking just the same because we share the landmass with all kinds of people here in the United States. Mm-hmm. And therefore, as a society, what is the way out, or do you see a way out of this power and race conundrum?
Well, Eutrice, I see that there is some way out, and one of it is going to be that, you know, we are avoiding this topic, and we're going to say that you're going to have to fight your way out of it. And this is something that a lot of us think we don't want to talk about it, but it's going to come down to that, because when Europeans came over here and they took control of this landmass, how did they get control of it? They came in and they used force, brute force. They terrorized, they genocide, they fought, and they were able to take control of it. If black people want to get our liberation, because we can talk, we want freedom all we want, but always a good offense, you have to have a good defense. If you don't have a means of protecting and enforcing whatever territory that you gain, then you're going to be right back into bondage all over again. Because we want to think that we don't have to fight, that we can always just love and love each person and get along with each person, but it's not going to happen. It's going to come a time that you're going to have to use brute force. You're going to have to fight people off. That's the only way that you can protect your territory from invasion. You're going to have to fight. And for us to keep thinking, you know, especially the civil rights movement, you treat, because it is inbred into a lot of us that you have got to be nonviolent, you have got to be peaceful and all of that. But they keep writing out of the civil rights movement that there were a faction that used counterviolence. They used
let me bring this to your attention. In Ferguson, for example, the very epicenter of this renewed movement in the United States, especially among people of color, relating to the state, the military state, and the issue of rights. An election is coming up on April the 7th in Ferguson. And right now, there are three members of the city council who are up for re-election, and they've decided, well, they're not going to run again. There are others. There are three of eight, I believe, people who have declared the candidacies. But when the time for filing your petitions came, and that was on last Tuesday, only a few showed up. Here's an interesting thing, because in the immediate aftermath of the killing of Michael Brown, everybody talked about a movement. They talked about, Sharpton went in there, talked about a movement. What is needed is a movement. The people themselves said, you know, we have a lopsided racial arrangement here on three. Only three of the 53 members of the police force are African American in a town that is about 70% African American. So what I'm saying is, not only was a need for change identified, but the opportunity to change also was identified. But here we are, and an election will occur in April that will not, more than likely not, change, or if it does change, won't change much the racial profile of Ferguson, despite the fact that it was within the power to create such change.
But
how do you explain that?
What I'm saying, Utrice, is people are disgusted. You know, that's the only thing that I can think of. People are totally disgusted from the total system, because even if that police department was flipped, It was 50 blacks and 3 whites on that force. The culture of policing, the system that policing was formed under, you would still get the same result. You would still get the same result of brutality in the on the black community, because these black police officers, they're trained and they're in a system that is predicated upon looking at us as being threats.
But you're still giving yourself an easy way out. I'm saying, just the same, I get your point, and it's a very valid point. However, I'm still saying, here's an opportunity that that's clearly available, that could clearly have created a change. It hadn't been tried before, so rather than say, well, it can't happen, my counter to that is, well, at least have it on record that you tried.
I understand that, Utrice, but, you know, people have gotten to that point now in time now with us, Utrice, where people have been saying, okay, I'm going to stop participating in this whole entire system. They have completely just shut themselves down.
Because I got that. Whose job, therefore, and let's go back to Ferguson, whose job, therefore, is it to create the change that they say they want?
it's going to be up to them. These individuals, they're going to have to define for themselves what type of system that they want to run within their community. If they want to do it, they're going to have to put it, map it out, put it on some sort of paper, and go it from there. Because if you
but
know, withdraw,
what they're saying, it was, I'm going back here, because this is the conundrum, too. The conundrum is that there are opportunities to begin the process of setting things in motion. This is not a solution, but it is at least an indication of the ability to see that you can create within your own realm of control something approximating change. But here in Ferguson, given all that has happened, the historicity of Ferguson, Plessy versus Ferguson. This, well, it wasn't against Ferguson the town. It was Ferguson against his so-called owner. But we're talking here. He's buried very close to Ferguson. But the idea is we have to call into account on all sides. Whose job is it to create the change that we say we want? And why is it in Ferguson that we don't see, you know, the effort being made to take advantage of it? And I understand your point about people being fed up.
Yeah,
however, I also contend that something else happened here, that there is no desire to even try.
Well, you know, you Therese, to go back to correct one thing, the Plessy versus Ferguson was a separate but equal that stemmed mm-hmm. from New Orleans with the guy riding on the rail car. That is that decision. The other decision with situation here with Drew Alorta. I'm getting a senior moment. I'm sorry. With what's his name and the Supreme Court decision with Roger Taney. That's another different decision with the Dred Scott decision. That's it.
Right. Yes.
So those are two separate incidents. But no. But what I'm speaking on with them, you know, sometimes, you know, people have gotten so fed up. Therese, it's like with us, we say we're going to withdraw from the electronic voting system until we see something better that comes along. Then we might get back into it again. And I think with everything that has happened over there, that people have gotten so totally fed up and they see no way out for themselves right now. They just think that lack of participation, let the whole thing collapse on itself, might be a solution for them. They just don't really want to even try and fix it right now. They just want the whole thing to just go away and just start over from scratch. That's what I'm taking from it. If you say no one has started to file any paperwork to be a part of that.
A couple of people have, but I'm saying, given what the opportunity presented itself, the opportunity that presented itself to create change, to seize upon it and create change. And this was the change that people said they wanted. This was the change that they said they were dedicated to creating. And this is what we got.
Unfortunately, Therese, as you said, you know, some, you know, people, the apathy and everything with the U.S. electoral process, a lot of people have just, you know, they have just seen that they've been down this road and they probably think it's going to be the same thing and they just decide, you know, to heck with it, and they want to go a different route. So hopefully you could get someone else from down there who could get on the show, and they perhaps tell you what's going on with the process, the electoral process, how those people feel and what it is that they plan on doing with the
process. Oh, yeah, I'm going to do that. But I'm saying, though, we have to come to some discussion about what exactly do we envision as change and whose job is it? How are we going to do this? Or are we going to sentence ourselves to never-ending cycles of the same, thinking that, well, somewhere along the line, as Martin Luther King said, some people just think change is inevitable, so I'll just sit on the sideline and wait until it comes.
Mm-mm. No, that's not going to be... You see, religion, Therese, you know, we get back, we can talk about this some other time, but religion has set in an apathy with a lot of us where we say this wait on the Lord type mentality, that you wait for some kind of savior, somebody's going to come along and do it for us. That is what has been put onto black people, that some great person, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, somebody is going to come along and is going to lead us to the promised land. They're looking for that Moses, and it's not going to happen. It is not going to happen.
Well, thank you for your call.
You're welcome, Therese.
Thank you. We'll continue this conversation because it's necessary. Everybody's got to have a stake in this thing, because we cannot, it seems to me, continue as a society under the illusion of progress when we are very clear that a whole different reality exists. And if we are all going to live, we are sharing the same landmass, we have to have some kind of a compact as to how we will live. And the conversation is long overdue as to how are we going to structure our society and those things that control our society and therefore control our interaction with each other, our own notions of power and equality and freedom and justice and all these things that we assign to this so-called very progressive society that holds itself up to the world as the enviable template by which all other societies should organize themselves. We've got to have the conversation. We have to have the conversation. And there are more than enough books at our disposal. We have people who've written forever about these things. The question is, institutionally, where are we? Where are we going? What is ahead? And how do we situate ourselves to deal with this in the ongoing context of what we perceive to be a free society, a democratic society, a just society? We'll come back to this quite often, because this is very serious work that we have to do. We have to begin the conversation. I do want to thank you for joining me today and for offering your considered thoughts and opinions. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com or leadstories@utreeslee. Keep it right here on PRN.FM. Coming up next, Richard Martin with Wake Up Call. See you tomorrow.